The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
So the first thing I love to do is pretend your kids are having a fight in the background. So sorry, I think I hear trouble. So that's my one, but you can only use that once, right, in a dinner conversation. So then if someone else is sort of prodding and pressing one of your triggers and you're afraid you're going to get into it at the Thanksgiving table, one of the things I like to do is, you know, excuse myself for just a minute, I'll be right back, go to the bathroom, wait a few minutes, think of something else to change the topic that will have that person talk about them.
Run away.
Sit back down. Run away, but come back with a strategy. Like, Uncle Bob, I've been dying to hear about your beekeeping. How did you get involved in that? And sort of defer to them.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, another great bumper there, Mag. I like that. Yeah, good to be with you today. Are you ready for Thanksgiving? I think every family has somebody, not all of them, but I think the one thing that really divides us at the table can be politics, it can be environment, it can be religion, it can even be football teams, right? I mean, you name it. And I think it's also driven by a lot of personality. It depends on the personality of the person. Some people, you know, keep their opinion to themselves. Other people can get very angry over it and take it personally. Tomorrow's Thanksgiving, secular holiday, established in 1863 by President Abraham Lincoln, right? He said this. He said, "Thanksgiving and praise to our beneficent Father who dwelleth in the heavens." And it's a time when we should give God thanks. It's a time to get together with family and enjoy the feast. But the past 7 years have been quite wild, haven't they? Very contentious 2016 election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Of course, we had the 2020 election. This comes on the heels of COVID, which sent everybody home, and there were lockdowns everywhere. We had race riots in the country. We had the George Floyd issue. You have political tensions. Now you have war in Ukraine, war in between Hamas and Israel. You've got China flexing its muscles. So the atmosphere in homes can get tough. You've got the gender issue, right? You've got a lot of things that people differ on. You know, all this stuff that we're now seeing. Back in 2016, after Donald Trump won the election and families started changing plans so that they wouldn't be with relatives. You know, it's so bizarre. I saw stories about people who would not go to Thanksgiving dinner with relatives that voted differently than they did. Is that a good idea? Maybe if it keeps the peace. But really, you can't not talk politics for a couple hours while you eat some turkey and hang out with the blood, right? With your relatives. Come on now. I just don't get that. There was a couple who was planning to get married over that weekend. They went so far as to reschedule the wedding to Italy so that the groom's grandmother and aunt, who both voted for Donald Trump at the time, couldn't make it. Could not make it. Lifelong friends who have been together since first grade and grade, you know, they're 40 and 50 year old people, you know, blocking each other from their social media platforms, no longer defriending them. So you can see, my advice to you is stay away from politics over the holiday. But there's a lot of other things, like I said, you know, environment, economy, you know, this transgender issue, you know, a whole litany of things. But Thanksgiving is a time that can also bring up past situations. You got your crazy uncle who drinks maybe a little too much. Maybe it's your crazy aunt who drinks a little too much, right? Who made the best pie or who made the best side dish or whatever it is. You know, there's all sorts of, you know, when family gets together, especially when alcohol gets involved, you know, all bets are off. You never know what happens. You know, our family, you know, we tend to agree with a lot. I do have a brother, one of my brother-in-laws, I'm on the opposite end of the political spectrum on, but you know, the wives always say, "Don't talk politics." So we don't. We don't talk. We don't talk politics. But I thought today we could dive into this. I'd love to hear from you. How do you handle it? What are some strategies to keep the peace? Alexandra Hudson is an award-winning journalist. She's an author and a speaker. She also founded an organization called Civic Renaissance. It's a newsletter and intellectual community dedicated to moral and cultural renewal. And I think it's important. I think we need more of that. Her first book was called The Soul of Civility: Timeless Principles to Heal Society and Ourselves. Check it out, okay? Came out last month from St. Martin's Press. It's well worth the read. You can find her online also at her website. She's got a website called alexandraohudson.com. Alexandra, thanks for being with us today. Good afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
I appreciate you being here. Great topic here. I mean, you know, you don't think there's going to be disagreements. You don't think there's going to be fights. Everyone's going to get together and just enjoy good food and football and have fun. But you know, inevitably somebody drinks too much or somebody says something or somebody misunderstands something or somebody didn't get enough sleep or something goes wrong and things can really, things can flare up. Should some people set ground rules? Because I think one of the greatest divides of all, and I threw out a bunch of them, is politics. For some reason, politics is like religion. People are deeply vested and deeply passionate about it. I know some people say, hey, at Thanksgiving, there's no politics. What's your advice?
No, it's a great point. I actually make a similar case in my book, The Soul of Civility. My final chapter is on misplaced meaning and forgiveness. And in that chapter, I argue that we've actually made idols out of politics in our lives. So as these traditional touchstones of meaning, church, faith, family, community have been on the ascendant in recent decades, we have attached ourselves to public issues. And that's where we derive our ultimate meaning and identity from. So when someone disagrees with us, it's no longer just a rational, intellectual difference between two people. We now interpret it as like an existential threat, and our lizard brains activate, and we go in overdrive, like we go into fight or flight. And that's a problem for our democracy, which relies on reasonable, deliberative discourse. And I actually borrow the framework of a Scottish theologian called Thomas Chalmers. He says, he has this lovely essay called The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. He says, if you have an unhealthy love to something like a sin or an addiction, it's not enough just to say, okay, soul, love this bad thing less. You have to displace the love with a better, more beautiful vision of the good, something better and more beautiful. And so I argue for us today, it's not, if we have this unhealthy addiction to politics and public issues, and it's invaded all aspects of our lives, including our family dinner tables, that it's causing us to cut people out of our lives, family and friends. That's an unhealthy addiction. We have to make it matter less. But how do we do that? We have to displace it with a more brighter, better, more noble vision of the good. So I talk about family. I talk about friendship. I talk about intellectual curiosity and beauty. These are a few of the examples I use of non-political endeavors that fill our souls and give us the equanimity we need to do life together better.
Yeah, I love that. My guest today, Alexandra Hudson. If you want to join us, share maybe what you've gone through, what you've encountered, how you put out the fuse. Maybe you got a question, a comment. Feel free to dial in. The number's 888-914-9149. We'll take your calls in just a quick minute. You know, I think politics are one of those things that you can set the ground rules for. I think that landscape is a minefield of differing opinions. I mean, we are so polarized politically today. I've never seen anything like it. And, you know, we want to have a peaceful full dinner. But, you know, sometimes things can sneak in. You know, they can make their way into the conversation. You might be talking about maybe the war, you know, over in Ukraine, or the funding of X, Y, and Z, or some other political policy, you know, some ideology, is immigration, whatever it might be, right? How do you diffuse that when that conversation sneaks in, when it creeps its way back in again? What are your strategies?
It's a great question. So part of the argument of my book, The Soul of Civility, is that there's a difference between civility and politeness, that today we often hear them used and use them ourselves interchangeably, but they're actually very different concepts and ideas. That politeness is manners, it's etiquette, it's technique, it's superficial, it's external, it's behavioral, whereas civility is internal. It's a disposition of the heart, a way of seeing others as our moral equals, who are owed and owed to others a bare minimum of respect just by virtue of the imago Dei, just by virtue of the divine imprint we all share by being created in God's image and by virtue of being members of the human community. And that crucially, sometimes actually respecting someone requires being impolite, telling a hard truth, engaging in robust debate. So that is a core part of my book that I argue throughout. However, as we approach Thanksgiving, I do give everyone permission to check politics and these divisive political issues at the door. My husband's excellent at this. Like, I live in a family that is like absolutely loving and wonderful. Right. My mom has four sisters, and she's my aunts often say to me, they have like thoughts on my life and how I should live my life, how I should raise my kids, how I should be doing right. things differently. Right. And they mean it out of love. Right. And I say, my husband says, you know, just don't, you have to respond. Just say, Nod and smile. Thank you. That's so interesting. Like, I don't have to respond. And he's so much better at that than I am. But like, that's an option. Like, you don't have to engage. You don't have to respond. Someone says something inflammatory. You don't have to meet them there. You don't have to speak your truth every moment of every day. Give yourself a break. And not all contacts are created equal. It's okay to like let the dinner table be about the bond, about hospitality, about gratitude.
Yeah. No, I could not agree with you more because, you know, I think about politics and religion. Those are two things that they tell you never to talk about. But, you know, the other things, as you point out, are controversial topics, you know, climate change, social issues, something that's in the news, money can be an issue, personal critiques like the aunt saying, why aren't you two married yet? When are you going to have a baby? Or whatever it might be, you know, it could be something more than that where people, they might be sensitive, something like that, and their button gets pushed. You in your book talk about civility. How do you define that, though? I mean, family is one thing. What are the challenges to civility, and how do you ultimately, how do you define it? What do you mean when you talk about civility?
Civility is the bare minimum of respect that we are owed and owe to others by virtue of our shared humanity, our shared dignity as members of the human community. And again, crucially, sometimes actually being civil to someone, actually loving someone requires being impolite. You know, again, like I said, breaking hard truths, engaging in robust debate. Or I love the story of Queen Victoria talking, you know, as we prepare for this holiday of hospitality, as winter, Thanksgiving and Christmas. Queen Victoria had the Queen of Persia to her home for dinner. And the Queen of Persia did the unthinkable. She tipped the bowl in front of her to her lips and drank it like soup, and the crowd gasped, and all the servants, like, they stood back and said, what's the queen going to do? Because it was a finger bowl. It was meant to wash your hands. It wasn't for drinking. Wow. What did the queen do? She tipped the bowl to her own lips and drank it as well. Why did she do this? Like, she was a fastidious, like, rule follower. This is a Victorian England, right? Named after Victoria. But she did it. She broke the rules of politeness to put her guest at ease. And for the sake of human flourishing, for the sake of community and friendship and conversation, that she knew, like, being a fastidious rule mongerer would have ruined. It would have defeated that end. And so sometimes it's okay to again, like, suspend the rules of etiquette in order to tell a hard truth or in order to put other people at ease. That it's often the most insecure people that are the most fastidious about the rules, wanting to look around them and constantly be calling others out for breaking the rules. But can we be self-assured enough and compassionate enough that we don't need to revel in other people's rule breaking to feel better, that we can in fact break the rules ourselves when the situation calls for it, like that story of Queen Victoria.
Alexandra, you have a history in politics, and it's a very different world and a very different culture as well. What did you learn there? Did you learn a lot of what you write about today from that experience? What kind of personal experiences influenced your view of civility?
I was raised by Judy the Manners Lady. My mother is an international expert on manners and etiquette. And I learned while writing this book that she is one of actually four women who are international experts on manners named Judy in the world right now. Maybe there are even more. I only found four, but who knows? Maybe there are more. The most famous is probably Judith Martin, the Washington Post columnist, who goes by Miss Manners. My mother's one of those Judys. So I was raised at home, like, very attentive to social norms and niceties. I always questioned them, and she promised me that they would lead to success in work and school and life. And she was right until I got to federal government. I was in Washington, D.C., 2017 to 2018. I took a role there freshly out of grad school, and I saw these two extremes. On one hand, I saw people who had sharp elbows, people who were aggressive, hostile, bullies, coercive, ready to do or say anything in order to get ahead and to win. And on the other hand, there were people who I thought were my people. They were polished, poised, and polite, but ruthless and cruel. They would stab me in the back, you know, smile at me one moment, stab me in the back the next. And that clarified for me this essential distinction between civility and politeness. And it was this environment that I lived and worked in that was absent of human flourishing. It was like anti-human flourishing. And that really galvanized me to write this book. I saw personally, experienced personally, and saw, lived through a very divided season in Washington, D.C., and I desperately wanted to be a part of the solution. I did not feel like I was being part of the solution in government. So I left to write this book and thought, you know, what does it mean to be human? What is the bare minimum of respect that we are owed to others by virtue of our shared personhood? And what does it look like in practice? even in this divided time. And so my philosophy of civility really is grounded in that experience and these questions and really the Imago Dei as well.
Yeah. Does forgiveness play a role in civility too? I mean, how does that play a role?
It absolutely does. I think especially in Christian circles, it's tempting to want to sweep disagreements, sweep, you know, grievances under the rug. That's a loving thing to do, right? To not bring things up, forgive and forget. But I actually argue that healthy human community, it requires confronting hard things that have happened to us. And it doesn't mean forgetting either. It doesn't mean just sweeping things under the rug. It means having a conversation. I think the human soul longs for healing and for reconciliation. We want that unity. We've had a rift. You know, we are deeply interconnected, and we're not at ease if we're at conflict or at in disunity with others. And yet, that's not always possible. It's not always possible to reconcile. And the beauty of it is that you can forgive without forgetting, and you can forgive without reconciliation. Like, reconciliation requires two people, but it's possible to forgive, you know, and move on without the other person acknowledging they've done something wrong or that another person being involved at all. And that you can forgive and not forget either. Like, you don't want to make the same mistake over and over and over again. You want past experiences to inform how we live in the present and how we, you know, no longer break vicious cycles. And so I think that is how civility and forgiveness intersect. That civility says, I respect you enough to confront you with how you've hurt me, or to acknowledge how I've hurt you. And we're going to talk about this. We're going to have this uncomfortable conversation, even if neither of us want to, for the sake of hopeful healing and unity. I'm really, you know, and I'm so imperfect at this myself. I say it's the Irish in me, but I have a long memory. It's hard for me to forgive sometimes, but I really am inspired and convicted by the passage in James that says, as much as it depends on you, live at peace with others. And that's really all we can do. All we can control is ourselves.
But my guest today is Alexandra Hudson. She wrote a book called The Soul of Civility, Timeless Principles to Heal Society and Ourselves. And pick it up, check it out, especially if there's division in your family. I invited her to stop by today to talk about how we can keep peace in the family over the holidays. Inevitably, sometimes tensions rise, fatigue enters in, you know, issues somehow push people's buttons. And we're diving into not just those issues, but the issue of civility. And you can join us. Maybe you've got a tricky situation in your own family. We'd love to hear from you. The number to get in, 888-914-9149. I only have her for a few moments, but we'd love to hear from you. 888-914-9149. I'll go to the phones in just a minute. You know, as you're talking and very eloquently and very beautifully there, I'm sitting back and I'm thinking, how did we get to this point? Now, I know you worked in the world of politics. I know you've observed this. I mean, it's not just the political arena. I mean, we see a lack of civility, neighbor amongst neighbor. I mean, there's shows dedicated to this. There's a show called Love Thy Neighbor or Fear Thy Neighbor. It's a reality show about neighbors who get so angry at one another that one ends up dead. You know, it's one of these like ID channel shows. It's crazy. But we're seeing this from neighborhoods to Capitol Hill. You're seeing it in school. You're seeing it amongst races and religions. You're seeing it amongst gender. What's happening societally, in your viewpoint, as you did your research on the soul of civility, where's this wound coming from, and what are those principles to heal it?
So there's no question we live in a divided moment right now. There's a reason I wrote this book right now. I experienced and witnessed firsthand the division in our world at the local individual level and at the macro level that's crippling our democratic institutions. And in fact, tiny footnote, I was invited to Canadian Parliament today. I'm currently on book tour in Ottawa, Canada, to talk about hyperpartisanship and how it's crippling our democracy and our free and threatening our free and flourishing way of life. So there's a reason to be worried about this issue right now. However, as I wrote this book, I came to appreciate that this is not a new problem. This is a very important question now. This is the most important question of our day. How do we flourish amid deep difference? But this is the defining question of democracy. This is the defining question of the classical liberal project. This is the defining human question. As long as we've been around, we've been trying to do this thing called life together with others. And that we're doggedly social as a species, but we're also defined morally and biologically by selfishness, by self-love. We're fallen. And those two facets of ourselves, the social and the selfish, are in tension. And that is why friendship, community, civilization itself, democracy is always fragile. It is never a foregone conclusion. So this is a timeless human problem. And yet, there are things in our current moment that have exacerbated it. Social media, the ubiquity of the 24/7 news cycle, public leaders that, you know, monopolize and take advantage of these technologies in order to create divisions and promote incendiary ideas. And my theory of social change, though, is about each one of us choosing to be part of the solution. It's to relocate our locus of control and choosing to lead lives that are tools of social and cultural healing, which I think Christians have a particular calling to. And especially as many of us go to our Thanksgiving dinner tables tomorrow and throughout the weekend. I don't know about you, but we have many Thanksgiving dinners in our home we tend to.
I love it.
You remember the words of Marcus Aurelius, who says, "You always have the option of having no opinion."
Yeah, I love
that.
There
are many great insights from Marcus Aurelius, but I think that's especially great. And it gets this idea that change starts with each of us, and we have way more power than we realize.
Well, Alexandra, thank you for being here. I am really grateful for your insight and your book, The Soul of Civility, Timeless Principles to Heal Society and Ourselves. People want it. Can they get it online, or is it at your website? What's the best way to connect?
It's available anywhere books are sold. Absolutely. But do consider supporting your local bookstore. I'm a big fan of supporting local independent bookstores. So ask your local entity to carry it and support them by buying it through them.
I love that. What a great message. Subsidiarity. I agree with you. Some of these big entities right now are just gobbling everything up. And I think we suffer as a result of that. Hey, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And good luck on that tour there. Okay. I hope you do really well.
Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks so much for having me.
You got it. That's Alexandra Hudson, The Soul of Civility. Some great principles to go ahead and to make sure that you keep peace, not only at the table, but in the world. And my advice to you here, too, and I was reading St. Jose Maria Escriva earlier today, and I'll share with you what he had to say. He's a saint of the ordinary life. But before I do that, stay away from politics, stay away from religion, stay away from money, stay away from controversial topics, stay away from personal critiques of others. You always have the option, according to Marcus Aurelius, right, Maggie, of having no opinion. That's perhaps the best. If something does come up, what are the strategies to do psychologically? Redirect. If something comes up, steer the conversation away. Like I always say, I'd make a terrible politician. Because I marvel at these guys, right? These guys, there's a bunch of microphones thrown in their face, and they're asking them a direct question. Did you know about this? Did you cheat on that? What are you going to do on this? And they start opening their mouth, and something totally different comes out, and they're babbling about it. And next thing you know, somebody else is asking them a question. The question never got answered. As a journalist, I'd be like, yo, you didn't answer my question, right? But redirect. It's a great technique. I'm not the master of it. I wish I was. I'm too direct. The other thing is affirm and kind of deflect. Acknowledge somebody else's opinion. Say, well, that's a really interesting point. I appreciate that. And then deflect, you know, go somewhere else. Hey, did you see the Thanksgiving parade today? Or hey, what was the score of that football game? I didn't catch the end of it. Go in another direction. You can always use humor. You can always, as we said a little bit earlier, set the ground rules to do that. But spiritually speaking, you know, maybe do what St. Jose Maria Escriva says. And if you're not familiar with him, he was a Spanish priest who had this divine inspiration to found Opus Dei. It's a Latin word that means the work of God. And basically, its mission is just to spread the Christianity, the Christian message. And the message is that you're called to holiness, regardless of what vocation you are and whatever your state in life is. To you know, work out your sanctity through that. And whatever your path is on earth, it's an occasion to encounter Christ. And he gave three bits of advice. And I stumbled across it earlier this morning. And he says, prayer is so important. You know, and I thought, this is such a great idea. He says this. He says, prayer is a time for holy intimacies and firm resolutions. And he gave three pieces of advice from a book called Furrow. And you can put them into practice. He says, before your family arrives, say a prayer. You know, he says, I like to say the Our Father, Hail Mary, and come Holy Spirit every morning. You know, ask God for peace in your home, resolve to do the work of keeping peace, but pray. I think it's a great idea. You know, I'm a believer in sacramentals, blessed water, blessed salt. You know, ask the angels to intercede, go to the angels of the person that's coming, that there's peace in the home. But pray, just say a prayer. You'll be surprised at what happens because there are spirits of division that often like to enter. The other thing he brought out, point two, he says, it's not good. It's not enough to be good. You need to show it. What would you say of a rose bush that produced only thorns, right? And the point here is that you have to show kindness to the person who gets under your skin. You know, do they have a favorite dish? You know, find out, maybe surprise them with a nice meal when they come to the house, or a bottle of wine, or the whiskey they like, or whatever it is, you know? You might even see the softer side of that particular person. A simple gesture of kindness can really change everything. And then the third point he has here is this. He says, practicing charity means respecting other people's way of thinking. It means rejoicing at their road to God without trying to make them think like you and joining you. That's a tough one. What's that mean? It says, you know, you might see your relative for the first time in months, right? Or years, or maybe it's the irritating cousin or whoever it is, or somebody's friend who's came to the house. You know, maybe they're not living in communion with the faith. Maybe, you know, maybe your heart aches for this person, right? Maybe you really feel bad for the person. Remind that person, if you can, if it's your aunt, your uncle, your nephew, whoever it is, how much God loves them. But leave it at that. Don't try to convert somebody. Right? Don't try to force conversion over the dinner table. Don't try to beat them in a theological argument, right? Don't try to outwit them with whatever the argument is that they're trying to put forward. Speak a bit of truth, plant the seed, and leave it at that. St. Jose Maria says each person will reach God by following his own way. So don't get sidetracked in comparisons or wanting to know, you know, who's higher. It doesn't matter, he says. What matters is that we should all attain the end, and that is heaven. So some spiritual advice for you in terms of keeping the peace at the table via St. Jose Maria Escriva. I'm going to take a short break. I'll be right back. We'll talk with Peter Atkinson, who's stopping by. A lot to get into right after this.
Getting you connected.
The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio. This is the Drew Mariani Show.
Hey, if you're in the market for health insurance, well, our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is here to help you and your family find the most cost-effective health plan. Learn more at relevantradio.com/Forester.
So I fill your plate and fill your drink. Put your dishes in the kitchen sink and let the leftover year just wash away. As we made it through, I do believe, the longest year in history. Thank God that it's Thanksgiving Day.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, an early happy Thanksgiving to you. If you are driving to your loved ones, be safe. Record travel. That's for sure. Airlines are jammed. There have been a lot of delays. And, of course, the roads are no fun either. But just be safe. Be tolerant. Be patient. Maybe an act of charity right now. I know you're tired. Maybe let that person in front of you or get off their back, right? Don't tailgate. You know, don't text. My wife's always saying that to me. Don't text. And she's always teasing me. She says, if you text and you get an accident, there are no prayers. She threatens me with that, but she's kidding. But no, it is. It's very, very dangerous. I see people on their phones all of the time. So be safe out there. Put that phone down if you're listening right now and you're just trying to answer that latest email or latest text. A lot of turmoil going on in the world today. One day we're going to have driverless cars, which will be cool. You can sit back and text all you want. And with AI, I have no doubt that day is coming. And honestly, I'm looking forward to driverless cars, and I'm kind of looking forward to artificial intelligence. Although there's some concerns about it on a number of different levels. Friday, the board of OpenAI, they own ChatGPT, and you're probably familiar with that name. We've talked in the past about Sam Altman. He was the founder of Chat and or OpenAI. He's on the board, fired, and the board never fully explained why. When that happens, I'm always curious. I'm like, why was Sam Altman fired, right? So there was an implication that he hadn't been honest with the board, but that really wasn't it. There had been some tensions between Altman, who's pushing the boundaries of AI, and some of the board members who have deep reservations about it may have locked horns. 2 days later, what do we see? We see Altman
He was hired by Microsoft. And they're, by the way, a major investor in OpenAI. And that led to nearly all of the more than 700 OpenAI employees. They wrote a letter to the OpenAI board saying the board should quit. Otherwise, they're going to go to Microsoft. So it is a fiasco right now. Those employees, they got their way. The new board, there's a board. Then, and Altman's been rehired as the CEO of OpenAI. That's good. I don't know where this is all going. I've been talking about it, been following it. It's the story's still being written. OpenAI is apparently the leader right now in artificial intelligence in the country. So open conflict like this is going to cause turmoil in industry. And with Altman now back at the helm, things seem to have settled down, at least for now. But here to bring me up to speed on it, because it's about all I know regarding the Sam Altman story, is Peter Atkinson. He directs the Merry Beggars here at Relevant Radio. Of course, he's been following this story closely. We were talking off air just about AI and where it's going. He says, the AI we're using today is the worst version we'll ever experience. I find that fascinating, Peter.
Yeah, no, it's incredible to watch this going on, because this is the first time that a story this size about technology, emerging technology, it's the first time that anything of this consequence has been mostly unfolding on Twitter. X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. So all through the weekend, I could not keep my eyes off my phone because Sam Altman was offering statements via Twitter. The person who fired him was talking on Twitter, and then they were. And part of the reason that this is more than just your local gossip column is OpenAI is arguably the most advanced artificial intelligence company in the world right now. They have received $13 billion of investment from Microsoft. They have been, they're relatively recent. They started in 2015, and they've broken through large language learning models. They've developed just the most advanced artificial intelligence technology available. Yeah. So to have the founder of that get ousted by a board of directors, it would sort of be in the technological world, it's the equivalent of having the Federal Reserve chairman ousted. Wow. Right? There are consequences that ripple throughout the entire economy. And with OpenAI, one of the things that was really shocking about it was Satya Nadella, who's the CEO of Microsoft, he didn't know about it before it happened. Sam didn't know about it before it happened. This didn't seem like a deliberative process that resulted in an employee leaving a company. It sort of seemed a lot more like an ideological battle about what artificial intelligence is and what direction it should go in.
Yeah, well, where are they now? I mean, where's Microsoft on this? Because, I mean, I know they're investing in this, but what does this mean for Microsoft?
Microsoft was a way you can say this? They were annoyed, to understate it. Satya Nadella did an interview with Kara Swisher, who's a tech reporter, and he basically said, "We love OpenAI, we love Sam Altman, and this is never going to happen again. They're going to change the board structure, make sure they have more control over it." Their investment is one of the largest investments in artificial intelligence, but I think it's going to be matched by Google, matched by Apple, matched by Amazon. Every single company is going to put in $10 to $50 billion at least to invest in artificial intelligence. There's just no way around it.
Where are we on that race? We know chat's first out of the gate. The first person out tends to get the biggest following. You have OpenAI. So where's Google? Where's Amazon? Where's Microsoft? Where are all the rest of these companies?
So the other companies that can sort of compete on this level are Apple, Google, and Amazon. Those are sort of the big ones. And Facebook, Meta. Facebook has launched a few different versions of it. Oh, and I should say Twitter. So, and they're all launching their own versions of artificial intelligence. Apple is slow out of the gate, and they tend to try to perfect technology before they release it. So they just released their immersive goggles that, yeah, Meta had released a version a couple of years ago. Apple has released it, and we'll see when they come out with artificial intelligence. But the problem they have is their version of Siri. Anyone who has an iPhone knows that Siri is not quite that smart. It really struggles. And so their stock has fallen. They've posted their fourth quarter of losses, which is the longest they've gone for a while in terms of sales, because people perceive them as not being up to speed with artificial intelligence. So they're going to have to pivot a lot, trying to invest a lot of capital into this to catch up. And then the problem is their company culture is so obsessed with design and perfection. Will they be able to function in a modern environment where
they're going to have to?
ChatGPT went from 1 to 100 million users in the time that it took Facebook to do that was like 10 years. Wow. So the speed of acceleration and adoption is just, it's funny. You read business books from like the 1950s and they're like, well, you see, technology and the economy, it's moving so fast. People can pick up the phone. And now it's a week happens.
It's crazy.
It's just unbelievable how fast things are moving.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a television commercial for, I think it's Google's new phone, and they're talking about having AI incorporated into it.
And so, so Google is developing their own chips. They're going to be incorporating it across all their products. The nice thing about Google is they don't care about privacy. They'll eat your data, scan your home, you know, peer inside anything they can. And as a result, Google is actually pretty smart. You say, sorry to all the listeners, but you say, hey, Google, and suddenly, you know, you can get what you want. You say, hey, Siri, and suddenly you have to run over to use your phone because Siri never works. Amazon, so it's interesting because each company has a different incentive around how AI is going to be incorporated. Apple uses AI, and they're going to have to figure out a way to bring AI on your local hardware device. They're not going to have it in the cloud because it tends to be privacy first. So how is that going to work? Google, on the other hand, they're going to integrate everything into their Pixel phones and have everything be cloud-based and just eat all your data and make something cool happen. Yeah. Amazon is going to use Alexa and AI to really deliver your toilet paper faster. Wow. Like Amazon really is just about delivering home goods and making money off of consumer items. So their AI is going to be focused on fulfillment, manufacturing, supply chain, so on and so forth, and of course, Alexa. But Amazon has also pulled a bunch of their Alexa devices off the market. So they've been pulling back from that. So the direction AI goes is interesting. Meta and Facebook is also, I'm curious to see where they go. They overinvested in the metaverse, and that totally failed. They pulled back on that. They pumped their ads business. They have more revenue than they've had in a while because their Facebook ads really sells. Will they go all in on AI and have another faceplant like they did on the metaverse, or will they, you know, come up with a new strategy?
So a couple things just tangentially here because you piqued my interest, and I want to talk about why the metaverse failed, right? So I want your take on that. But before I get to that, you talk about how Google is just super invasive. Your emails, your navigation system, everything, the things that listen in your home, et cetera. Everybody's got a Gmail account, right? There's a million people with these Gmail accounts. Do you use a Mac account? Do you use some other account? And is Apple more secure than Google is?
So I am 30 years old. I have grown up being accustomed to my privacy being non-existent. Right. So I've that ship has sailed for me. I use Gmail. I assume that every communication I send is being looked upon by our dear federal government and by Google. They have been notorious for putting ads in your email inbox, which necessarily mean that you're using data from the emails. And of course they always say, you know, this is anonymized. This is not known.
Right.
What's interesting, and this is a layer of how AI is really changing things. So Apple did a branding technique that Scott Galloway from NYU calls laddering, which is you focus your brand around the weakness of your competitor in order to highlight how much better you are than your competitor. So Apple, a couple of years ago, started orienting their brand towards privacy. Why did they do that? Was it because consumers cared a lot about privacy? Sort of. It was mostly because Google...
I like it.
but it was mostly because Google and Facebook could not actually keep user information private because their business model depends on harvesting your data in order to sell relevant ads. So by focusing Apple's brand on privacy, it weakened Google and Facebook. It destabilized their brands. So they did that, and they caused they made it so that user activity on phones by on Facebook apps and Google apps was not able to be tracked on iPhones. And people in the business world were really scared. They were saying this is a death blow to Facebook's business model because Facebook basically is an ad server that, you know, delivers Drew Mariani ads about what Drew Mariani likes, and it knows what Drew Mariani likes based on your activity on your phone through the Facebook app. Now the scary thing is after Apple stopped Facebook from being able to track user data on the phones, they used artificial intelligence to cover that gap. What I mean is they used artificial intelligence without even knowing your data. Wow. They were able to use artificial intelligence to create a model of what Drew Mariani would do.
Yep.
And then deliver ads without even tracking you that were just as relevant and, in fact, more relevant to your activity.
Wow, that's
so that's
wild.
The scary thing. And that's why I think privacy is sort of a myth at this point in our culture.
Yeah, I agree.
Even if you keep all of your information private, your emails private, everything under password lock and key, you can use artificial intelligence to predictively model what people will do in their lives. If you have it like maybe 3 or 4 data points about Peter Atkinson, you can figure out, oh, I like my coffee black. I'm Roman Catholic. You know, I pray in the morning. I have a dog that I don't walk as much as I should, right? All of those things, that's the next frontier. People think of data as you collect it, you analyze it, you deliver it. What artificial intelligence is starting to be able to do is you get 3 points of data, that's all you need. You can predict the rest. And that is a fairly scary, but really interesting thing.
I remember when it first came out, and I have to take a quick break here, Mag. When we come back, we can talk more. I asked it to write a promo describing the Drew Mariani Show. It wrote such an eloquent promo. It was better than any of my team or I could have written. I thought, oh my gosh, it's as if though he was listening to the radio show.
Yeah,
I mean, it was concise. It was in the 30-second window that we needed. And it was like, it was off. I said, my gosh, I can't get over this. It was stunning. And that was early.
Yep.
This stuff is only going to get better. Peter, hang with me. I'll take a short pause when we come back. I know we're dropping the Christmas car. I want to talk about that. I still want to hear about the metaverse. I want to hear about AI in warfare, because I know that Israel is now being accused of using it. There's concerns about the ethics behind that. There's so much to talk about. You can join us too. We only have a couple minutes though. 888-914-9149. We'll be back with more conversation right after this.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, if you're in the market for health insurance, well, our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is here to help you and your family find the most cost-effective health plan. Learn more at relevantradio.com/Forester.
I've got plenty to be thankful for.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
To sail from shore to shore till
that's Maggie's wedding song. I'm just kidding. Right, Maggie, what was your wedding song? Did you have one?
It was a Chris Stapleton song.
Oh, was it really? How cool. I like that. That's awesome. How about you, Peter? Did you have one?
Laverne Baker, which is a 1950s singer.
Oh, how cool. That's awesome. We only have a few minutes here. So let me get back to the conversation. I'm going to take a call, too, for you, too. If you want to join us, my guest, Peter Atkinson, 888-914-9149. AI, we'll grab a call or two. I also want to talk about what's happening here at Relevant, Peter, with you. But before we do that, couple concerns regarding OpenAI right now. Ethics is a big one. Its impact on education, we know about. Ethical concerns over it being biased, right? But also warfare. You know, I mean, the president just met with the president of China, Xi Jinping. We know that Israel and Hamas are going at it. Reports are coming up that Israel has used artificial intelligence to get information, where to target, a whole litany of other things. It's been very effective. There's a lot of people who are coming out right now saying, hey, we've really got to be careful about the incorporation of artificial intelligence into warfare. And again, you wonder how far that goes. Will it one day be a Terminator-like thing where you have create machines and devices that that make decisions, life and death decisions should always be reserved when it comes to warfare to human beings. But your thoughts on all this?
Have you ever read Brave New World?
I did, yeah.
This is one of the directions that we're headed. I think it's hard to underestimate how much artificial intelligence is going to turn some parts of our society upside down. But I also think it's important to distinguish between different types of artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So AI has actually been around for decades. It's been incorporated into our economy for decades. But the thing that we're seeing, which is new, is called generative AI. Mm-hmm. And it is able to create large paragraphs, essays, long thing, you know, pieces of text that are really contextualized, that seem really intelligent, so on and so forth. And same with images and videos. That's what's new. With Israel and warfare, yeah. Drone targeting systems have been around for a long time, right? Obama got into trouble for using too many drones. So that type of artificial intelligence, I think, is not really the new kid on the block. Right. The new thing is the fact that, all liberal arts kids in universities and middle schools and high schools will be using ChatGPT, whether teachers like it or not. That's and so that's going to upend our education system. And
but I hear they have something out now that can detect if it's written by an AI.
Yeah, that's probably good for a week.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably good for a week, maybe 2 weeks.
That's
but
so funny. It's so true.
AI. So the other thing that is also going to upend everything is... Yeah. There is a artificial intelligence program that was developed that, you know how the FBI and the government will release documents with FOIA requests and they'll have redacted words or redacted statements in them. There was someone who developed a model which was able to use predictive AI to guess the words in redacted documents with something like an 80 or 90% accuracy.
That's wild.
What does that mean? That means that security as we know it is not going to exist in 10 years or much, 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 much sooner. And we, you know, not to scare anyone, we've seen this happen before. I was just talking off air with you about multi-factor authentication. So if any of our listeners have ever had, they've tried to log into something and then they say, well, you know, you need to check your YouTube and then press a number or get a text or whatever. All of that evolved from the fact that people got better at hacking passwords. So I don't know if we're going to move more towards a biometric security environment where, you know, maybe we don't all get new computers, but we get little biometrical plugins that can plug into our computer and develop an encryption key. So there are going to be ways to react to this, but the security environment, you know, the password to your bank account, the password to the nuclear submarines is very much at risk with the more that AI develops. And, you know, don't even talk about election.
Yeah, no, this election is going to be radically different. I was having a conversation with somebody about the amount of deep fakes that we're going to have on social media and what people are saying. I almost want to just stay away from it all.
Yep,
it's going to be scary stuff. Dee Dee in Phoenix, thanks for waiting. Good afternoon.
I have a question for Peter. I was trying to say Mr. Anyway, this is my question. It sounds as if this AI has almost a godlike predictive capability. Now, isn't that, if it's capable of doing that, isn't that an interruption of God's personal plan for each one of us?
So that's an amazing question. And AI is not as smart as it appears. One of the things that's really interesting about AI is it's able to produce products, you know, text, video, sound, that looks like it's created by an intelligence, but all it's actually doing is statistical analysis. So, for instance, there are weather meteorology computer models that people have been using for a long time. And before predictive generative AI, they were using what I would call a first principles approach. So scientists would put into a computer program, these are the principles of how water affects air, affects currents, affects weather, so on and so forth. So you could see like, oh, well, if there's a rainstorm here, then the atmosphere is going to be affected XYZ. Well, there's a new model of meteorology programs that used only pattern recognition. In other words, they were able to put in historical data of weather that have happened over the past couple of decades, and they were able to predict with a lot less computing power and a lot more quickly and a lot more accurately what the weather would be next week than using the first principle models. What does this mean? It means that the generative AI is just using patterns. It can't actually tell you why it's predicting what it is predicting. So if the weather prediction was wrong with a first principles, you could look at the computer model and say, well, this scientific formula was wrong, or this piece was wrong. With a new AI system, it could be wrong. There's no way currently to know why, because all it's doing is guessing based on statistics. So good example is if you use AI to write an essay, you'll find very quickly AI has no conceptual depth. It doesn't understand logic. It doesn't understand rules. It doesn't understand ideas as ideas. What it does is just operate on the level of language. So it can create a pretty picture of words, and it's incredibly powerful at that. But it has no intelligence.
Dee Dee, thanks. Peter, I don't want to run out of time. I want to talk about A Christmas Carol as well. We have probably about 2 minutes left, so I want to work that in. I'd hate to miss this opportunity to get people plugged in.
So A Christmas Carol is completely artificial intelligence free. I'll segue that way.
I love it.
So we're releasing A Christmas Carol December 1st. It's a full cast adaptation. If your listeners go to adventwithscrooge.com, they can sign up for free and get an audio advent calendar of A Christmas Carol with a full cast of actors, music, sound effects. It's one of our favorite productions, and I always love how the audience responds. So they can go to AdventWithScrooge.com to sign up.
AdventWithScrooge.com. And you know what? We work in the same building. You're in the same. Pop in the studio next week and we'll talk about it and remind people, because I think it's a classic.
It's absolute classic.
It's so great. And you did a wonderful job on it. Really did. Phenomenal. I am out of time for the day. I want to wish you all a very blessed and happy Thanksgiving. I'll be praying for you. Enjoy your holiday. We'll talk again soon. Stay tuned. Kale Clark is straight ahead.